I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. An FDA panel of experts has given the go-ahead for what may be the first race-based medicine. This is a drug called Bidal. The company that makes Bidal says it has been shown to have significant effects in treating African Americans suffering from heart failure. Well, the question is why? Some insist there are biological differences between the races, and it's only natural that drugs can be engineered to adapt to those racial differences. Others say there's no hard scientific evidence of a biological distinction between the races, and that race-based drugs could lead to medical discrimination. Today we're asking you for your thoughts. Should medicine be colorblind? Isn't that part of the whole principle of people being created equal? Or would that close off a path of research that needs to be explored? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We have a couple of medical experts standing by to help us out. First, though, to Chris Rowland. He's a reporter with the Boston Globe, and he's been following the Bidal story. Chris, it's good to have you with us.
Good morning.
Now, I understand last week this panel of experts at the FDA approved Bidal and approved the use of a label that says this drug is for African Americans. Does that mean it's all done, or is there more approval required here?
Well, the advisory panel makes a recommendation, and now it's up to the FDA to make a final determination on whether or not it goes on the market. They could do so conceivably as early as tomorrow. I think the side effects of these two of the two generic drugs that went into this new novel drug
right.
are well known. So I don't think there's a lot of safety issues. It's more of a political issue.
And the FDA usually goes with the advice of its experts, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So and this is like a 9-0 vote by the advisory panel. So it's pretty likely that it will be approved.
Chris, I want you to help me, if you can, with a little bit of the history here. I understand that Bidal was initially tested, some 20 years ago. Is that right?
Yes. So it's a combination of two generic drugs that have already been widely on the market and widely available. 20 years ago, some researchers decided to put them together, thinking that there might be some benefit there, if nothing else, for convenience sake. They did widespread clinical trial that then showed really no benefit in a broader population.
So they set it aside for 20 years, but they set it aside for a period of time and then only recently went back to it?
Right. So the FDA said, look, this drug's not going to work. So then Nitromed out of Lexington, Mass., stepped forward and mined the data and found that there was a subpopulation of African Americans that did appear to benefit. So they subsequently did another round of clinical trials comparing it just within an African-American population and determined that, indeed, it did actually have a benefit for that for those folks and that it was 43% benefit compared to placebo.
In fact, the results were so striking, they stopped the trial and said, hey, we really need to make this available for
yeah,
people, right?
Yeah, and it was quite striking. And, physicians who treat a lot of cardiovascular disease among blacks said this is a real gap and we need to get this drug into the marketplace.
Now, my understanding of it, Chris, is that one of the areas of dispute is the science here, trying to figure out was that test enough of a reason to say this is a drug for black Americans? Can we make a link between genetics and biology and race and medicine? And nobody seems to have a firm answer on any of that.
Right. Well, that's one of the peculiarities of this story and this drug is that, the future of sort of genetically engineered medicine is going to pull us into the direction of targeting specific medications for specific subcategories of the population based on race, age, genetic profiling. The funny thing about this is that these are just two generic drugs that were not genetically engineered, they just by chance happened to find that they appeared to work better among blacks. No one knows why, really. They don't understand fully the underlying science. So it's sort of pulling us into this new frontier, but not really on with the underlying science fully understood.
Okay, well, we're going to go a little bit further with that underlying science and ask some of the bigger questions. Chris, I want to thank you for starting us off on this. I appreciate your time.
Oh, sure. Happy to help.
Chris Rowland is a reporter with the Boston Globe who's covering the story of Bidal. And let me introduce to you now the guest who will be with us for the balance of the hour, Dr. Joseph Graves, joining us from a studio in Newark, New Jersey. Joseph is the author of The Race Myth, Why We Pretend Race Exists in America. He's a professor of biological sciences at Farley Dickinson University. Joseph, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me on the show today.
And also with Joseph, Dr. Keith Ferdinand. He's in a studio in New Orleans. Keith was one of the scientific investigators for the Bindel studies, medical director of the Heartbeats Life Center in New Orleans. That is a cardiovascular center. He's also a professor at Xavier University College of Pharmacy. Keith, it's good of you to be with us as well.
Good morning.
Do you have any second thoughts about the idea of prescribing a drug for someone because their skin is a certain color?
Well, actually, that's an oversimplification of how the Bindel process came to be and how it would be utilized. We all know that race is a very crude proxy for any biologic process, and it's really not based on a specific gene or set of genes. But the idea is that if you wanted to see if a drug responds in a self-identified population, you study that population. And the results are that you have a 43% reduction in mortality, that's death, a 39% reduction in hospitalization, and an improvement in quality of life. And it's the dirty little secret about medicine and studies, and I do quite a few studies, is there's not much that we do that improves survival. There's not much that we do that decreases mortality. So this is not really a question of whether or not the drug is effective. It's effective, and it clearly is effective in this population, which was self-identified as African-American. The race question, the genetic question, I think may be something which is interesting, but I think the data are the data, and specifically as it applies to patients who have heart failure, I would have hoped that the FDA would say that this drug is effective for the reduction in mortality, in hospitalization, and improvement in quality of life in patients who have moderate to severe heart failure. This was demonstrated in a trial of 1,050 self-identified African Americans, period.
Can I ask you just a clarification here? When you say self-identified African Americans, what do you mean by that?
Well, as I said, there's no genetic testing that was done. There are a set of patients in the study who are going to be checked for a certain polymorphisms of some genes. But in terms of the general cohort, you would go to the clinic, you would describe yourself as African American, the investigator would accept that, and you would be entered into the study. So it's a very crude proxy for any genetic basis, and certainly no one who is really interested in helping these patients would suggest that it confirms some genetic hypothesis.
But the short version is crude but effective. Let me turn to Joseph Graves on this. Joseph, based on what you know, I mean, on what we know about this study, what Keith's telling us is pretty persuasive. Would you give this drug to someone based on the color of their skin?
From the data that I've seen, the drug is effective for patients with moderate to severe heart disease. I would try it on any patient. I think it's absolutely correct that one does not know anything about genetic polymorphisms or even environmental sources or even chance effects on individuals that determine the efficacy for this drug for that individual. The first study of Bindel actually was very close to being statistically significant for the Veterans Administration study. It was very close, and there were criticisms of the way the study was set up by the biostatisticians on the FDA approval panel, so the drug was not approved in the initial study. The results were simply stronger in the self-identified African-American population.
Okay, but here we have the FDA contemplating putting its stamp of approval on a label that would say, you know what, this is a drug for African-Americans. Are you quarreling with that?
I quarrel with that because, one, the way the drug has been tested, we simply do not know if it's going to be effective for individuals without regard to their ancestry. I think it should be approved because it's been shown to work. But the FDA trying to make this a racial drug, and I've talked about this widely, and I've written two books about the problem of so-called race-based medicine.
Yeah.
It's completely – it doesn't understand what we mean by race. It doesn't understand what we mean by genetic variation. It doesn't understand how environment influences an individual's predisposition towards disease. It's a gross oversimplification.
And Keith Ferdinand –
can I jump in here?
Yeah, please.
Well, one of the things that probably is a little bit misunderstood, I was on the steering committee for the study. I was one of the investigators for the study. I have no stock in Nitramed. I'm not one of the people who own any of the patents on the medication. I was paid as a researcher, as most researchers are paid when we do clinical studies. That being said, I don't think anyone would really argue that being self-identified African-American means that someone is saying that you should look at a person's skin color and just choose a drug based on that. Physiology, or how the body responds to a medication, is difficult for us to understand. It may not actually be genetic at all. For instance, if you have long-standing hypertension, poorly controlled hypertension, with time, the heart becomes weak and it starts to fail. Mm-hmm. That person then may have damage to their vasculature, which is going to respond to isosorbide dinitrate, which is one of the compounds, because it gives a substance called nitric oxide, and it's going to respond to hydralazine, which is another vasodilator, and it's also an antioxidant. Who are those people? Well, those people are often people who have blood pressure, which is poorly controlled, long-term, damages the blood vessels and damages the heart. And that identifies a large amount of African-Americans, and health-seeking behavior comes into play, socioeconomic status, how doctors treat patients, the lack of getting black patients to appropriate goal. So the physiology may be a marker for a lot of things, but it may also suggest that a drug responds in a certain group.
All right, Connection listeners, we'd like to hear from you. There is a troublesome and long history in America of political and social decisions based on race. Now we're talking about a medicine that may or may not respond to people based on race. And if that takes us down the road of race-based medicine, does that take us back into the area of making biological differences based on race? Or are we, in fact, heading into a brand new field of something called pharmacogenomics when we are studying exactly what drug would suit you best based on your age and your height and your sex and perhaps even the color of your skin? Which direction are we going here? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. The FDA is poised to give its final approval to a new drug called Bidil, and the drug would have a sentence on the label saying that this is a drug for African Americans. Of course, a doctor can give it to anyone, but the research is indicating that it may, in fact, be America's first race-based medicine. Well, where, in fact, is that kind of medicine leading us? Should race be a factor in choosing medical treatment? Do you take it off the table? Is that just as bad? 1-800-423-8255. We're going to take our first call from Hyde Point, North Carolina. Tim's with us. Hello, Tim.
Hello. How are you doing?
I'm fine. What do you think?
My question would be more of, it's already race-based in a sense that the African-American community is already being treated for sickle cell anemia, that there seems to be some kind of genetic link there that doesn't show up in the white America. Just wonder what your guests would have to say on that.
Keith, you know about this. Do you want to help out?
Yeah, well, sickle cell anemia does have some genetic basis. It actually may be a survival benefit for people who are exposed to malaria, that patients who have variants of the sickle gene actually have less of a toxic effect when they're infected with malaria. But again, it's really not just race, it's also environment, because if you look at the Mediterranean basin, there clearly are groups of people in southern Greece, people in southern Italy, even some people in the Middle East who have sickle cell anemia or sickle cell types. And again, it may be protective against infection with malaria, such that if you had a population whose ancestry over thousands of years were infected with malaria, those people who tended to have these variants would survive. So it's really hard to make a determination just based on skin color. A person can have a light skin and actually have sickle cell disease.
And Joseph Graves, go ahead.
Yeah, because this is my field. I'm a population geneticist. One of the most common misconceptions about sickle cell anemia is that it has something to do with skin color. If you go to Kenya, you have low-altitude Kenyans that have sickle cell anemia in their population. And you go to high altitudes in Kenya, and you have no sickle cell anemia there because the mosquitoes that carry the disease, malaria, are not found at those altitudes. My colleague has already pointed out that throughout the Mediterranean basin, there are populations with varying levels of the sickle cell gene depending upon the frequency of malaria. In fact, you can map the frequency of the gene worldwide by the frequency of malaria transmission, and that includes India in the Far East also.
So
it has nothing to do with skin color. It has to do with the presence or absence of malaria transmission in the region.
All right. I just want to make sure that I'm completely clear on this. When we're talking about then why certain people have that in them, do we refer to it as a genetic inclination towards sickle cell anemia and something that may, as you say, come from environment or geography, and it may be more inclined to show up in people with darker skin? But
actually, in the case of sickle cell anemia, you're talking about a gene with high penetrance. And the term penetrance means that if an individual has a gene, they're very likely to develop the disease. Now, how do you get this gene? You inherit it from your ancestors. And ancestral groups from all over the world where malaria was present have this particular gene. The only reason we think that sickle cell anemia is a black or African disease in North America is because the slaves who were imported to North America came from regions in Africa that had high frequencies of the gene and of malaria transmission. If we had brought Yemeni slaves to North America, we would think that this is a Middle Eastern or a Yemeni disease, right, not an African one.
Back to the phones, to Charlottesville, Virginia. James is with us. Hello, James.
Yes, hi.
What are you thinking?
Well, I'm thinking I'm very much in line with what the gentleman just a moment ago was saying, that just hanging the label, quote, race-based medicine alone constantly raises an issue that really has no place in the discussion. And to even call it race-based is such a misleading fact. As was said, after doing the metadata research on this particular drug, they found that a particular group that, as he said, was, quote, self-identified, and it was based on nothing other than, as this fellow said, just a lot of slaves that were imported from a particular part of Africa, that somehow makes it, quote, a black disease. And this is really a misnomer. And
well, okay, but you know, it is the FDA, James, that is saying, yeah, it's okay to put this is a drug for African Americans on that. I mean, that is, they're making that racial distinction. They may not be making it because it's, you know, anything other than the trial that the company showed up with. But
you,
I mean, it raises the question, though, doesn't it?
Well, not really. Well, it does raise a question, and I think it's the mistake is labeling like that. The penetrance, like he says, the penetrance. You have a Jewish community that has a high penetrance of Tay-Sachs, things like that. These particular conditions have a genetic root that are a consequence of a particular inbreeding, or in the case of Africa, a survival benefit from far back. But that doesn't make it, quote, a black disease. And I think that you do the black community and the white and medicine a big disservice, and that includes the FDA, by calling it that. But if, as a matter of fact, you can look and say these people are self-identify, the real answer is of course, before you prescribe a medicine, and this is pretty expensive, is you look at the alleles. Does this individual express the alleles that seem to be...
I don't know what alleles means, James.
Oh, a particular gene. A particular gene. If they are demonstrating a particular gene, I might have it. I classify myself as white, but I might very well have that gene. And
can I ask you a question, though, James?
Sure.
Why is it that you're not comfortable with the idea that we would at some point in the future, 2 years, 10 years from now, be talking about race-based medicine?
Because it forces people into categories that have no business being there. That's why. It creates a very false overburden that restricts basic science research. It maintains an ongoing set of circumstances they're not beneficial to anybody, any group, any non-group. And that's the reason I really don't like it.
So, Keith Ferdinand, why then make this decision to test over 1,000 African-Americans only using this drug in the first place?
Well, that's an interesting question. When you look at what's called subgroup analysis, you look back in the study and you look at a group of people who were part of a study, sometimes you get quirky results and results that really don't reflect what you thought you should see. For instance, there's a large trial called the LIFE trial, which looked at a drug called losartan and compared it to an old beta blocker called atenolol. It was a large trial, international trial, 9,000 patients. But then in the subgroup of patients who were 533 self-identified blacks, they didn't do too well in that study. And it led the FDA to suggest that this particular drug shows benefit in patients who have hypertension with an enlarged heart, but that benefit was not demonstrated in African Americans. Again, it may not be genetic based. Maybe the African Americans ate more salt, had more obesity, were less, were more stressed, mm-hmm. didn't come to the clinic for follow up. Who knows? So what you do then, if you want to show benefit,
couldn't all those questions be asked about the people that you tested? That there wasn't enough, perhaps enough clinical information about the 1,000 African Americans who were tested.
Yeah, but hold on to that concept, and I'm going to explain to you why you do a test or a study in a subpopulation. If you want to show benefit in a subpopulation, then you get a sample size which is big enough and robust enough to show benefit in that population. It doesn't tell you whether it's genetic-based. It really doesn't really tell you much about the history of that particular population, except that it works in that population. Now, let's study that population. They were about 55 years of age. Most of them either had idiopathic, which means you didn't know why they had heart failure, or they had hypertension. About 40% of them had diabetes, especially the women. The average weight was 93 kilograms, which 2.2 times 93, about 200 pounds. So these were people who had big body size, a lot of volume, probably ate a lot of salt, probably had burnt out hypertension, were already middle-aged status. Now, if I see someone who is so self-identified as white, or I see someone who self-identified as Hispanic, which is not a racial term at all, it's a demographic term, if they meet some of those criteria, I probably would use the combination of isosorbide dinitrate and hydralazine, which is going to be marketed as Bidil, in that patient. But if you want to show benefit specifically in self-identified blacks, you need to do a study in that population, because if you don't do it, you're going to be ending up with subgroup analyses and you're going to still get these little crooked results. We need to study populations. There's no problem with that. The problem is when people then say it's a race pill, a black pill, mm-hmm. or that it's based simply on skin color, and it really isn't.
Yeah, Dick, can I get in here?
Yeah.
There are real reasons why this conversation is sort of spinning off without any direction. And that's because we're not really defining what we mean by race with regards to biology and medicine and how race is used socially. The average person on the street sees a series of physical characteristics and will then lump someone into a category that they've been taught is a race, such as that's a black person, that's a Chinese person, that's a white person. These are social terms. They have some relationship to underlying genetic variation, but they don't map directly onto that genetic variation. And here's two examples that prove why I don't think that what we're seeing in Bidil is really a genetic difference. If we look at hypertension rates in the Western Hemisphere, we find that Caribbean people of African descent in the Caribbean and people in North America, African descent in North America, have very high hypertension rates. And they have the same gene frequencies for particular systems related to hypertension, such as angiotensin-converting enzyme. When we look at Western African populations who have the same genes, same frequencies as in the Caribbean and in North America, we find very low levels of hypertension there. Yet they have the same genes. Now, another example.
Can I get you to hold that?
Sure.
We have a pile of people who want to get in, and I want to make sure that we get to them. So let's go next to Raleigh, North Carolina. Stephen's on the line. Hello, Stephen.
Hello there.
What do you think?
Well, I wouldn't put the sentence on the bottle. That's just a little too flatline. Because I would go back to then and ask, well, what about gender-based medicine? Because I remember a comedy sketch Bill Cosby did years ago on My Doll that, oh, I'm taking this drug, and it's great, and it's wonderful, but, you know, I'm feeling a little, growing a little here. It's like you're not taking into account everything about the person, you know, because if you put somebody behind a screen and didn't tell somebody what their skin color was and had the doctor do all the tests, they're going to base their medical diagnosis on the tests that they see and the history they've got from the person, but they're not going to look at the skin color.
So in your view, Stephen, and I don't know if you're a scientist, I'm not, I need to look at this in fairly simplistic terms, but I'm wondering if you see this as, you know, the first step in a very long journey towards figuring out exactly how you do design medicine based on someone's, yours or my, genetic makeup, and that as we head out on that journey, we're going to get sidetracked by socially loaded terms like race-based medicine, that sort of thing.
Well, that's the problem. It's a socially loaded term, as you're, you know, expert was saying, here is a psychological term versus a medical term, and really in the next 10, 20 years, they're going to be able to pinpoint what's wrong with you mm-hmm. based on you and your physiology and your, you know, the whatever's biologically a part of you. Because they're saying, well, this is, you know, African-American. Okay, what are the children of a mixed-race marriage going to become? Are they, now they're not even pure of one race or the other. How do you say, well, this, you know, this boy, he doesn't look like he's black, but he's got the, his father was black, so therefore, you know, he is, this drug would be good for him, but you can't look at him and tell
him. Yeah, I know. Then we get back to the comb test, and we don't want to go there. All right, Stephen, I thank you for your call. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Keith Ferdinand, I'm wondering if you share the perspective that there is a hole in the science here that we're trying to sort of step across, and maybe we're just not far enough along yet to figure out how medicine can be designed for specific individuals because it gets so complicated.
Yeah, that obviously is true. And if you listen to me, I'm trying to be as specific as I can. I don't necessarily believe that race is a biologic term. It's a social construct. It's used by demographers, military people, historians, social scientists, etc. But I do want to use this big platform that you have to mention that black people die, and they die more than white people in the United States. And it probably is a mix of social, biologic, physiologic, but there's also health-seeking behavior, the lack of health insurance, how doctors treat expert specialists. For instance, my clinic is located in an area. We have 3 board-certified cardiologists. You could throw a brick, you wouldn't see another one for miles. Mm-hmm. And that is a harsh reality, and there have been several studies that have shown that. And it translates into life expectancy. In the last census, black men live 68 years, white men live 75 years, about a 7-year gap. Black women live 75 years, white women live 82 years. And cardiovascular disease is the number one cause of death. So my interest is trying to decrease these disparities. I certainly don't want to give credence to the idea that we should do racial profiling or we should have race-based medicine. But at the same time, I'm not going to close my eyes to the reality that black people are dying at excessive rates from cardiovascular disease, again, related to a mixture of problems and not simply based on genetics.
Keith, isn't there also, though, a risk that some bean counter at some health insurance firm is going to take the kind of statistics that you just quoted and encourage employers, you know, oh, you're better off hiring the white people because they last a little bit longer. They don't have the same kind of heart difficulties. And I'm not trying to take us down this path that, you know, we're heading into a world of race-based medicine, but kind of holding that door open and saying, if you go there, you're going to have these kinds of social decisions that are made. And though they may be wrong, people are going to have to cope with them. And those decisions will affect people's lives.
Absolutely. There's also that fear. And I share that fear, but I also will not agree with closing our eyes and saying, America the beautiful, kumbaya, we all are equal when black people are dying disproportionately. And that's a harsh reality. We have to deal with it. We have to look at some of the reasons why physiology may not just be genetic, but it mm-hmm. can be environmental. Black people have hypertension that starts early. It's poorly controlled. They can't afford the drugs. There's less specialists available. Doctors in certain studies, when blinded to the race, will actually not treat a person differently. But when they see a person with a certain skin color, perhaps they do make decisions inappropriately so.
Okay, so
that doesn't mean you don't study. That doesn't mean you don't study a population. Yeah. It just means you try to weed out those situations.
Joseph Graves, just a quick one from you because we're coming up to a break here. Is that persuasive enough to put that writing on the label of the bottle of Bidil?
No. And again, I'm going to make it very, really, really clear here. I mean, we have studied how much of health disparity is genetic and how much of it is environmental. There was a very excellent study done in New York last year, published out of New York last year, that looked at African-American mortality and survivorship over the 20th century, compared that to European-American and Caribbean Hispanics. And we found, in that study, found that African-American survivorship and mortality, and this is from all causes, was only 4-16% genetic. That means that it's 96-84% environmental, the kind of things that my colleague at Xavier is talking about.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Can medicine be colorblind? Should medicine be colorblind when you start tossing around terms like a race-based drug? Does that complicate an issue that the science hasn't really solved just yet? What are your thoughts? We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. As the FDA is making up its mind, a final decision on how Bidil is to be marketed and whether or not it is to have a label that suggests it is a better drug for African Americans, we're taking a look at the question of race-based medicine. Is it something that is ahead of us now? Dr. Joseph Graves is with us. He's a professor of biological sciences at Farley Dickinson University. His most recent book is called The Race Myth, Why We Pretend Race Exists in America. And Dr. Keith Ferdinand is also with us. He's medical director of the Heartbeats Life Center. It's a cardiovascular clinic in New Orleans. And he was on the steering committee and one of the scientific investigators for the Bidil study. A reminder, our number is 1-800-423-TALK. Back to the lines next to Los Angeles. And Lindsay's with us. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi.
Tell me what you think.
Well, I think that this topic is extremely important. And the issue, in my mind, I'm a physician, is that race is really a surrogate marker for our genetic makeup, which is very complex and has been pointed out that the science of the genetic causes of diseases in our body's response to an environmental pathogen or an infection is highly variable, but highly likely to be driven by our genes.
Okay, so you're a doctor. You're going to have patients coming through your office all day long. Are you, when you talk about this as a surrogate marker, do you take race into consideration when you're doing your diagnosis and when you're prescribing medicine?
Absolutely. And I want to give you an example that's a contemporary example. I think that Dr. Ferdinand points out a problem. It's tragic that it took 20 years for this drug to be recognized as effective in African Americans. And I think that it highlights a very important process problem at the FDA where new drugs and biologics aren't necessarily tested in adequate numbers of people most likely to have the disease. In my area, which is hepatitis C, which is a chronic viral infection, goes on to chronic liver disease requiring liver transplant because it results in liver failure and mm-hmm. cancer. The first effective treatment was identified and FDA approved in 1989. By 1994, we knew that 1 in 50 Americans has this disease, but among blacks, that number is 1 in 17. Nonetheless, the drugs, as they evolved and got better and better in terms of eradicating the virus, getting rid of the liver disease, were not adequately tested in blacks.
Lindsay, can I just a quick clarification here? Were those studies also looking at the people based on where they lived and what their income was and what their life circumstances were? Or was it just we're looking we're making those racial distinctions?
The studies were not. The subjects for the studies were not selected in any way. And so it was a random sampling of people, but only at certain centers, and it just turned out that the centers that were selected did not have large numbers of African Americans in their patient population.
Lindsay, can I just ask you to hang on a second? I want to go back to Joseph Graves on this, because Joseph, she's talking about race as a surrogate or a crude marker in a doctor's office, and I mean, is that not better than no marker at all in the way that she's describing it?
She's misrepresenting the way genetics works, I've written two books that deal with this issue about the complexity of gene by environment interaction. There's no way to know for a particular disease system whether it's responding more to variation in genetic composition or more to variation in environment. And again, I'll give you some recent data. There was a survey done on so-called race-based drugs that was published in an issue of Nature Genetics in November 2004. It looked at drugs that were claimed to have a race base and found that only 1 of 22 had a demonstrated genetic component in the direction of the differential. 6 out of 22 had a supposed physiological basis, but no genetic basis. 5 out of 22 had no demonstrated physiological or genetic basis.
I'm getting lost in the numbers. Where are we leading with this?
10 out of 22 were false positives, meaning that they weren't racially based at all. In other words, out of 22 drugs that are supposedly race-based and based on genetic differences, only 1 of 22 was successfully demonstrated as being the result of a genetic difference.
Lindsay, let's hear from you on this.
Well, the problem is that when we test drugs, we don't test them in that way. We test them for specific diseases. And my point is that if you know that a certain group of individuals are highly likely to have the disease, you want to make sure that when you test the drug, you test the drug in that population. It turns out that now we realize that African Americans respond to this drug one-third the rate in very well-designed, well-controlled studies as non-African Americans. Now we realize there's a problem, but we have to backtrack. You know, we could have known this 10 years ago.
Yeah, but it's scientifically impossible to say the difference results from genetics simply because you don't control environment. Now, I do quantitative genetic experiments. I do laboratory experiments on longevity. I know the theory really well. Unless you can control not only for current environment, but also for maternal environments, at least two generations, you cannot determine that something is a genetic effect. In other words, you could be seeing significant differences, such as in Bido, which are simply the result of different environment. And in fact, the heritability studies that I just discussed indicate that is precisely what we're looking at, but that African Americans have a different environment, and in particular an environment that is socially subordinated to the majority population.
But the point that Keith made earlier, Joseph, is setting all that aside, if the medicine works for this population, for this group
but
of people.
It's important to know why the medicine works, because when you start a research program, if you begin with a false set of assumptions, you're not going to be able to determine, or you're not going to be able to direct it in a way that you're going to have results that are consistent. In other words, if most of the work that's been done so far shows that genetic differences between so-called races is not responsible for the result, then you're looking at the wrong thing.
Keith, let's hear from you here.
Yeah, well, self-identified African-American status may not just be genetic. It may be physiologic environment. I've made that point. So it doesn't mean you don't study it, and maybe we should do more study to see what exactly is it. Some people even think it may be maternal influences in terms of low birth weight babies or having early child nutrition not being adequate. And a lot of those things are being funded in terms of the food nutritional programs and the Head Start, et cetera, which the government is about to cut back. But that may actually impact on a person's rate of cardiovascular disease later in life. So I think both of you are making excellent points, and I'm not afraid to do studies. Perhaps we should be careful how we interpret studies and make sure that we're not overreaching in what we are saying about studies. Let me ask the doc from New Jersey one question. You know, in the hypertension field, and,
yeah, she's,
and I do
she's
a lot
not
of
there.
Research.
She's no longer on the phone, Keith.
Okay. Well, Graves, you can answer it. In the hypertension field, we see some side effects with medicines, which definitely, clearly, in self-identified racial status, seem to be a little bit quirky and they're different. For instance, angioedema with ACE inhibitors in blacks. How do you explain that? And I'm not trying to be cynical or trying to put you in a box. It's something that we see in multiple studies. Are you aware of that, and what do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm aware of the side effects, and there's no way to know because there hasn't been a study to determine whether this is a gene or a set of genes or whether they're environment. And that's the problem I have with how many of these studies are being done. And I'm sure you're aware of all the studies that have looked at allelic differences between populations and found that European Americans have the same alleles and, in fact, at higher frequency than the ones that have been associated with disease pathology in African Americans, yet they're not showing that disease pathology, which, again—
But the angioedema—
Sure, go ahead.
I'm sorry. But the angioedema, for instance, which is swelling of the lips and the face, can be a pretty bad side effect. And it may actually be life-threatening. And a National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute-sponsored study called ALHAT, which is the largest antihypertensive study ever. It's not a drug study from a pharmaceutical company. The blacks who took the ACE inhibitor lisinopril did have more angioedema. So I just don't want to do a null hypothesis that there's any basis to differences between populations, but I would agree with you that it really is not based on specific genetic markers.
Let me, if
yeah,
I can.
I agree. I mean, the reason I'm in support of using Bidil is because it's been shown to work in self-identified African Americans, whatever the reason.
Let's go back to our callers. 1-800-423-8255 to Northampton, Massachusetts. Andrew is with us. Hi, Andrew. Thanks for waiting.
Thank you. Could you answer this without using words you find in a medical dictionary? I'm wondering, is the FDA accepting or proposing a definition of African American, and should they?
No, they're not. They're going to probably label it as a drug that's effective in African Americans, and they may say that this effect has not been demonstrated in other populations or whites. I'm not necessarily encouraging that. It's not my decision. It's the FDA's decision. And I think they're basing it on the fact that if you do a study in a particular population, then that's the population that's going to get the labeling or the approval for it. And as I mentioned to you before, there have been large trials in which you have smaller groups of different populations and you get quirky results. They go the opposite way as the major group. Now, we don't know why that is. Perhaps the group that you studied was too small to make a confirming finding. So, but the FDA is going to say, well, you studied self-identified African-Americans. Well, dog it, that's what we're going to label it as.
Well, Andrew, do you have a reservation about that?
Oh, I mean, I think that this might lead to Medicare or Medicaid approving or rejecting certain medications for certain races. And I'm wondering how the FDA can make a recommendation that they can't define.
Keith.
Yeah, I think they're making it based on the science. And I think when it comes to Medicaid or Medicare status, those are particular situations are not taken into account. You're not going to have a drug which is going to be denied a patient based on race. I think that's just too charged. It's going to be too emotional of an issue, and it's really politically not correct to say that if a person has one race versus another, they should not have access to a medicine.
You don't think that a white man with a serious heart disease could request Bidil and find out from his or his doctor that the studies say it's not good for you, it's good for African Americans?
Well, the study doesn't say that. The study says it was beneficial in self-identified African Americans. It doesn't say it's bad for whites. And actually, Dr. Graves did make a point. And again, we don't want to get too technical, but the p-value, which is statistical significance, was 0.06 in the first study for the whole population. So it was close.
Yeah.
It was close for everybody. It wasn't as though the blacks who took it had this great, great response and the whites who took it had this bad, bad response. It wasn't that simple.
I'm interested more in the principle of the question than in the
In the science?
Yeah.
The principle of the question is, I think we should have medications available for all people based on what the clinician thinks will help that person, and I don't think we should use race as the judgment for that.
Let's go back to our lines to Belmont, Massachusetts. Vince is with us. Hello, Vince.
Hello. There was an editorial in the Sunday Times on this issue, and they pointed out that Nitromed, the company developing this drug, actually has a patent or patent application that will extend their protection for this product until 2020.
Yeah, it gives them like 13 years as opposed to...
Based on selective use in African Americans, as opposed to it the patent on the drug itself expiring in 2007. And this really raises questions about the motivation of the study design, whether medical considerations really had very much to do with it. And I just think that should be part of this discussion.
Keith, I've read this a couple of times, that by being specific about the patients that the drug can be used for, the drug sort of shifts onto a different plane where Nitromed gets all those extra years of patent protection. And people are saying, well, it's economic. It's not medical.
Well, that's true, because if you have a labeling that's very specific, in order to have an extensive labeling, then you'd have to do further studies for further populations, so they give you time to do further studies. But I was on a steering committee for the study, and I was an investigator. I can tell you I don't recall any discussions, any mention, or any hint of that. That only came out when it came time for approval. Now, whether someone in the corporation may have had that in mind, I can't say. I'm not a stockholder. I'm not an officer of the corporation. I don't have anything to do with the patent. My interest was in seeing what we could do to help black patients.
All right, Vince, thanks for your call. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. 1-800-423-TALK. Next to South Carolina. Rhonda's with us. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi.
Tell me what you're thinking.
Well, I'm a registered nurse, and I've worked in cardiology for a long time, and there's always been a disparity, and I think it's supported in the literature and in a lot of research, with women and heart disease and how we get treated, often given a Valium and told it's anxiety, go home. And I think we have a drug here that we're talking about on this program, and it's unfortunate that we're putting a racial label on it if it's a medication that works. As a practitioner, we have an ethical responsibility to give a patient that a drug that works for them, and I think to also not give it or give it because we feel that it has a racial label or slant to it.
I mean, one of the things that's come up in the program, Rhonda, is the different categories. There's more often than not much of a question about the gender of the patient or the age of the patient or the height or the weight or all these other things that might go into a doctor or a nurse's consideration about how to administer a certain amount of treatment. But race gets a little bit fuzzy.
Well, that's true, because some of the literature that we have does show, and obviously I think all we've talked about all this, there is a higher incidence of hypertension in African Americans.
Right.
We do see a whole lot of it here in South Carolina, and I've practiced in New Jersey as well, so I can appreciate the previous physician's call. And we may not know why, and we don't have the research yet necessarily to understand why and have the basis for it genetically or whether it isn't genetic, but we do have a drug that we know works in this particular population of people, and I think ethically we need to focus more on using it rather than focusing on whether or not it's appropriate for that patient's race.
And Joseph Graves, isn't that really what the medical profession is going to end up doing until there is more solid science making these genetic connections that are still lacking?
Yeah, and they're going to do that, and that's one of the reasons why I've always advocated that medical schools need to do a better job teaching population and quantitative genetics in their curriculum. I taught Darwinian medicine at Midwestern Osteopathic Medical School in Arizona precisely for that reason. I also want to make the point, Dick, that gender isn't as simple as you make it sound either. There is a huge spectrum between people who are genetically female and people who are genetically male, and those differences in hormonal levels and brain function can be medically relevant. So a lot of the things that people think are real are not.
Keith, quick last question. Yeah, go ahead.
Good news, our study had in the Bideal group 46% or 48% women, which is very high. It's higher than seen in the other populations, and the women did benefit.
And do you suppose, Keith, that 2 years from now, if we have another conversation about this, that we'll be talking about evidence from the use of this drug among the general population that will bear out what you saw in the study?
You'd have to have what's called a registry where the doctors would voluntarily send the company information of patients they start on the medicine, or you could do what's called a post-release analysis, or you could do a study in which you do a post-marketing study. The doctor fills out a little card and says, I put this patient on the medicine. This was their racial or self-identified racial ethnic
right.
group, and here's the result. I don't know. Hopefully they'll do something like that. I'm not opposed to the idea of trying to look further.
All right. Thank you very much for being with me on the program, Keith.
Oh, I enjoyed it. Anytime.
Dr. Keith Ferdinand, Medical Director of Heartbeats Life Center in New Orleans and a scientific investigator for the Bideal study. And Dr. Joseph Graves, thanks for your time as well.
Thank you for inviting me, Dick.
Joseph is a professor of biological sciences at Farley Dickinson University. Earlier in the program, we talked briefly with Chris Rowland from the Boston Globe. Our program is produced by Katie Bacon, Sarah Baker, Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts, with help this week from Chris Engels, Addie Goss, and Maura Kelly. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.